This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Respond 25, Australia's only paramedic careers conference. Join us this August in Brisbane as we explore the vast opportunities for paramedics outside of traditional ambulance roles. You'll network with some of the best employers, educators, and trailblazers in the industry, but tickets are limited. So to find out more and secure your place, head to www.theshiftextension.org.
What are we talking about?
Your microphone's up near your head.
Ooh, that's better.
So should number four be down?
No. Oh, yes. Yeah, because there's nothing in number four.
So that should be down?
Yeah.
Phone?
Down.
Blue light?
Down.
No light?
Down.
And?
Can I have some length?
USB.
That's good.
Yep.
USB.
Is that your tape?
Down. That was my tape.
it sounded like you just backwashed that.
No, I was just taking a prolonged slurp because it's
hot. How did
you
backwash that?
That's no backwash, mate.
That was all backwash.
Where's your tea?
I haven't made one yet. I just wanted yours. I just wanted a little bit. I don't want a whole tea. I just want a little splash.
I didn't want your tongue in my tea.
But we're friends.
Not that close.
Come on.
Colleagues?
Acquaintances?
Yeah.
Acquaintances?
What are we talking about?
I don't know.
How about PPE and why we shouldn't share body fluids?
I think that's a good one.
Lou had some ideas.
Yes. Lou had an idea, ideas for a mini-series.
A mini-series? Mm-hmm. What was the mini-series, Lou?
Outside the truck. Paramedics outside the truck? Paramedicine outside the
truck? Paramedicine.
Paramedicine.
It was your idea.
Yes, there's been a bit going on.
There was a little cyclone called Alfredo.
Little?
Yeah, just a mini, just tiny.
A little bit of wind?
Just a bit of wind.
I still don't have power.
It's a bit of wind.
How many days has it been?
Seven.
Oh.
7 days,
I think.
Oh my.
We've got a generator.
A generator?
It's keeping the fridge going. Heaved the barbecue onto the deck. Now we can cook. The most troublesome thing, though, is boiling bath water. I ended up with like third-degree burns on my thumb from...
Why are you boiling bath water?
Do you know how cold the showers are without hot water?
No.
Happy. Oh. A little cyclone indeed. Lou.
Yes.
It was your mini series.
Mm-hmm.
Paramedicine outside the truck.
Mm-hmm.
What did we talk about last time?
Event.
Oh, festival.
I found that super insightful.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to talk about today?
I'm trying to think of what we've just mentioned.
Actually, Lou is number one today.
I'm number one.
And Lou also featured on the cover of a magazine recently.
She did.
And Lou was also recognised in public recently.
What?
Lou is number one.
I'm like sweating.
It's because it's hot. Do you have your aircon on?
It's really uncomfortable.
Do you want the air on?
Well, we don't have aircon. We don't have power. I don't even have a ceiling fan. I've got like a little Azito fan
it's
from
sunny.
Bunny.
I would have brought my Milwaukee.
That's okay. Lou, you wanted to speak about paramedicine outside the truck because
yes.
There's so many different areas that people can, I don't want to use the word specialise in, but certainly take their practice into. Mm. We spoke about events, which I found insightful.
Festivals.
There's also a lot of paramedics entering into the humanitarian space. And it's an area that is still, let's say, reasonably controversial. Because of the way paramedics are educated. The humanitarian space is certainly aimed towards primary healthcare more than anything else, but everyone there needs to be ready to respond to any given situation. So it is an interesting dynamic place. Nick, have you ever worked on a humanitarian deployment? Have you ever worked on a disaster deployment?
I've done some disaster deployments in Australia.
Mm. There's a lot of crossover here.
There is a bit, yes.
What were the disaster deployments?
Well.
How many?
Like four.
Four.
Bushfires and rain events, mostly.
And what were the most challenging aspects of those?
Really, it's access to care that you can normally access, or what you're used to accessing that you can't access anymore.
In what way? Educate me.
So we're very used to being able to access a level of care from primary health care or all the way up to emergency care. But in a disaster zone, usually in Australia, it's not necessarily the fact that the care doesn't exist because we have like well-built buildings and hospitals are in good locations and we can get power online to critical infrastructure well, but we get cut off.
We have well-built buildings north of the Tropic of Capricorn.
Yes.
We've discovered since the cyclone came barreling towards the southeast that our buildings are not built to the same code. So if that cyclone did cross the coast, which it did, but it was kind of a lot weaker.
It was.
I don't think many of our buildings would have survived.
No. You'd think a hospital would survive, though.
You worked in Wide Bay years ago.
I did.
That place flooded years ago.
It does.
And did you know, Lou, the first places to flood were the base hospital, the ambulance station, and the fire station.
And isn't the base hospital the only public hospital up there?
In that area?
Yeah.
Correct.
For miles.
Talk about town planning 101. Now, my question around this to you, Nick, around these deployments is because I've never deployed to a disaster area. I've only ever been stuck in one, stuck in two. So I've always been the responder who's in the area that gets hit, and then we have the help brought to us. There's a lot of crossover I see between the disaster deployments and the humanitarian deployments or the humanitarian sector. But one of the things that I found interesting and almost humbling when I was in those disaster areas was this notion of, I'll have to call it a hero complex. People stronger than us, more equipped than us, coming in to help oppor us. And in essence, it's kind of true because we did lose the ambulance station, the hospital, the fire station. We were in inflated buildings within 48 hours. That was kind of cool. They literally brought inflatable tents and set them up. Did you know, this is just for future reference, that the actual structures of these tents are inflated via the air conditioners?
How?
The air conditioners are already pushing air, right? And so they actually get pushed into the structures. So instead of having, it is until you don't tell people like the Wayward paramedics who got cold during that first night shift and turned off the air conditioners. The first disaster hospital set up in that disaster zone deflated on all the patients that are brought in there to care for. There were patients and people leopard crawling out of that place.
That's amazing.
Wow.
The deployments, I guess, domestically are expected in Australia and certainly in this industry. But it's the humanitarian stuff that's, what, is that alluring, Lou? Is that unknown?
To me, it's unknown. It's not really anything we speak about.
So, but do you think that,
as a student,
do you think that disaster and humanitarian, you're saying that they have crossover, but can we differentiate them in a sense? Like, disaster seems to be responding to an incident, versus humanitarian can be you're responding to an incident or you're providing care to a low resource area.
There's a couple of different definitions that people have used in the past, right? There are natural disasters and there's human conflict. That's two ways of dividing this space up. Now, we don't have too many, I'm just trying to think if we've had any in my lifetime, disasters in Australia that are to do with human conflict. I would hazard a guess that there's been none in the last 4, 5, 6 decades. So it's something that we're a little bit unfamiliar with in even defining. But then there's also another way to define things between well-resourced or well-funded and poorly resourced and poorly funded, because you can have a humanitarian deployment into a poorly funded region that has been hit by a natural disaster.
What's an example of that?
Or you could even use Vanuatu as an example with Cyclone Pam. Ironically, this hero complex I mentioned with our own disaster, when Cyclone Pam was a Category 5.
Is that as high as they go? Is that?
They can go higher, but there's no category for it. It's just, holy shit, hold on. I think the winds exceed 300 kilometres an hour. Cyclone Pam impacted Vanuatu, which is defined as a low GDP country. And their buildings are certainly not built to cyclone rating. So it basically wiped the floor on the areas that it hit, and there's a lot of remote islands. So that would be an example of a humanitarian deployment to a disaster area. There are also humanitarian deployments in conflict zones. Use Ukraine as an example. There's plenty of humanitarian deployed people working within those spaces who are non-combatants. Same in the Middle East. So there's a number of different ways you can define this, and each of them have a vastly different experience for the people who are involved. But where do paramedics fit in this space, I guess, is probably the most interesting discussion. I think if I discount any of the army stuff that I did in the early parts of my life, I think I would have been involved in, must be nearly 20 humanitarian deployments. Taking the army outside of those, most of them are natural disasters. And most of those, I have not seen many paramedics. So it's no surprise to me that this is something that you don't understand. But I'm curious, Lou, what would be, when you think about a humanitarian deployment, and I don't want to use the word ignorant, because it sounds quite dismissive. What's another word for ignorant?
That naive. Sounds
nice. Oh, yeah, naive. What's wrong with naive? From a naive perspective, because we, you know, haven't experienced it. What's your idea of what happens on a humanitarian deployment? Do you have any concept of?
I guess it's meeting the needs of the people in the community, like whether that's providing them with food or water, shelter, and then healthcare.
What's that got to do with paramedicine? It's interesting where we break this stuff down
Why can't paramedics provide those resources?
Ooh, that's a controversial question.
Why can't we hand out, you know, food and shelter and like help with rebuilding and things like that? Why can't we?
Have we been trained to do it in this country? Or is that another service? You know, the SES in Queensland certainly are more aligned to that kind of tasking.
Mm-hmm.
But the question you raise is a relevant one. If you're smart enough to use a concoction of drugs on people in outside of a hospital environment, you're surely smart enough to grasp the basic needs of people, which are going to be food, water and shelter.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's a question. Are you going over there as a paramedic, or are you going over there as a humanitarian assistant that happens to have the right skill set from being a paramedic? And can offer paramedic skills as part of their what they bring to the team.
So what Nick has just touched on has been a discussion happening for about the last decade. And it's certainly been a quiet conversation because there's just not many actors in this space. One, the humanitarian actors don't fully understand the capability of paramedicine and where it's developed over the last two decades. And paramedics don't fully understand the humanitarian actors and how it's structured. What Nick has touched on, most of the deployments I've been involved in have been through logistical roles and administrative roles, but I'm there also because I have a clinical skill set, which means that you can be utilised in certain areas. And so most of the departments I have been involved in have been healthcare related. And the irony here, Nick, is there's actually a lot of crossover to the last mini-series topic, which was festivals, because you spoke about basically having a collection of 40,000 people and having to establish a clinic, a rove, a responding team, and for essence, a clinic. And when you look at the health side of a humanitarian deployment, you're looking at displaced people, sometimes 40, 50, 60,000 more, which is the same size as some of these festivals. And you need to go in there and establish essentially a structure that's going to provide support. There's not many paramedics who are used to going in to work in an area that doesn't have structure. Most are super experienced people, but they've worked within a very much environment of support and structure. And when you take these people out of that structure, a lot of them actually don't know how to operate or cope appropriately. So it's an interesting question. Are you going as a paramedic or are you going with a different set of skill sets? For me to get involved in this industry years and years ago was a different skill set, and it was around logistics and admin, but then building a clinical skill set. Where things are changing and where things are merging is the recognition of the skill level of paramedics. It's not now just focused on emergency ambulance. It's now focused far more on primary healthcare. It's focused far more on extended field care. It's focused far more on prolonged field care. And so if you can get a paramedic qualified person with some other skill sets around admin logistics, they're actually going to be a huge asset. I can see you scribbling notes furiously.
Would you like to share?
Maybe. I'll have to finish just scribbling. No, it's interesting because we are very much used to having structure. I think, you know, we like to, paramedics love to say that, you know, you can work in dynamic, challenging environments. But I think when you really break it down, there is a lot of structure and there's a lot of support, which is great because it allows us to achieve more. And it creates better patient safety and it creates better, we're more accountable for our actions from a governance perspective. It's good to have that structure, but I think that we're starting to lose some of that creativity and ability to improvise and adapt quickly when things change because we're starting to get used to having lots of structure and support. So when you lose all that, people go, oh. So I use the example of, you know, if you work for a jurisdictional ambulance service and there is a flood, like where I've worked, that area is prone to floods. And the biggest problem we have is access to healthcare. So you have patients who are isolated and we can't get to them and they can't get to us. So that person with chest pain or that person with abdominal pain, that job becomes a lot more protracted and more challenging purely because the roads that we're used to using to move someone from A to B are now cut off and we don't have another option, or we need to look at other options that we're not used to doing.
How does that complicate the treatment of said patient with chest pain?
It changes your appetite for risk. If I have a finite amount of resources available in an area to achieve an outcome, like move someone from A to B, let's use the example of a helicopter or a boat. You know, as much as we like to think that there's vast amounts of resources, even in Australia, there isn't the vast amounts of resources, then they can't be everywhere at any time. So let's say our roads are cut and we're relying on other resources to move patients, then we need to think more about how we decide who needs to go and how we prioritize those patients. So you might have six patients in the community and one asset to move them. Who are you going to send and who are you happy to keep, or who can you refer to, say, like a telehealth service, or can we find other ways to safety net these people in the meantime? There's a great example of 2011, the Grantham floods in Queensland, where they had a significant rain event and a large, almost tsunami of water came down through a valley and essentially washed a town away. And within the space of an hour, we had, I think it was about 30 or 40 people got killed and a whole bunch of other people ended up on their roofs needing rescuing. Helicopter went out, rescued who they could, and then they got to a point where there was a lady who was very pregnant. And they're like, well, we don't have enough fuel to take everyone back. So who are you going to take? So they put the pregnant woman on the helicopter and they left the doctor and the paramedic in the town overnight. And they said, we can't come back for you. The weather's too bad. Good luck. Like, no worries. So they went into this town where there hadn't been any water. There was a whole bunch of people turned up saying, I don't have power. My house has been washed away. What do we do? So you had two paramedics who started their shift without thinking that they were going to end up in this situation, and they were essentially at the start of a humanitarian deployment about 100 Ks from their own homes.
Well, they're also at risk themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think there's an element, you're talking about appetite for risk. I don't think people properly consider how risky the situation can become when you're outside of the structures of support and the structures of safety. Simple things that Lou raised earlier, you know, shelter, water, food. When you don't have access to those things, it's amazing how quickly you can deteriorate.
Mm.
And a lot of us have forgotten that because we have lived in such supportive environments. In these situations, I mean, we're talking about risk. I wanted to talk about responsibility too, because...
Are you ready to unlock exclusive content and take your paramedic journey to the next level?
We know that staying ahead of the curve can be tough, but that is why we created our membership program.
The Shift Extension Membership, where you'll gain access to premium resources, expert insights, and a community of like-minded individuals.
Enjoy early access to new content, exclusive events, and personalized support. Plus, get discounts on our training days and symposiums.
Join today and start achieving your goals faster. Visit our website or click the link in our show notes to sign up now. We're talking about... paramedicine outside the truck. So we're speaking about paramedics specifically, and there's a lot of paramedics out there who are quite interested in working in the humanitarian sector. But there's still very much trailblazers who are attempting to create the space for that to happen. And when that does, there's obviously going to be more structure and more opportunity. But apart from just understanding the raised levels of risk to you personally when you go into these areas. It also complicates the responsibility you have, because paramedics have historically been brought up to stabilize patients momentarily, and I use the word momentarily because, you know, in most metropolitan, even regional areas, there's a base hospital unless it floods and you're in an inflatable tent. But, you know, you're normally about 20, 30 minutes from a hospital, and so the levels sometimes of primary care and ongoing care have been omitted from paramedic education unless you've done some specialist training. And it's been omitted from a lot of paramedic education because the people delivering the education at the moment have not trailblazed into these areas to even understand this side of paramedic practice. But it complicates the responsibility, because suddenly you've got, let's talk, you know, the two paramedics who were in this town that doesn't exist anymore. They would have been used to doing their job well, using their equipment, using their structures well, stabilizing the patient, and then basically handballing them like a football to a receiving facility. And that changes dramatically when you can't, when you remain responsible for that person. And this, I think, is where a gap in paramedic education exists. There's a lot of good programs, you know, being raised around Australia at the moment in community paramedicine. And there's I think this is a powerful aspect of paramedic care that is only just beginning. But a lot of those programs are still very much focused too on ambulance structures and state healthcare. So they would apply to these disaster areas. But there's still gaps in where the humanitarian aspect sits.
I think this kind of speaks to, it challenges the very definition of what a paramedic is.
Ooh, what's a paramedic? Ooh.
So what's the definition of a paramedic, Lou? What's the traditional definition of a paramedic?
So glad he didn't put me on the spot.
You can edit this out. It's very dumbed down, but I guess a professional who can provide acute care to patients.
100%. That is the traditional definition of a paramedic. Go out there and provide acute emergency care to the community outside of a hospital. Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, maybe we should do this as its own episode. I think the definition of a paramedic should change, because we don't no longer just treat sick people. We treat all patients. Mm-hmm. We're a healthcare service. We're not an emergency service, like jurisdictional ambulance services are changing themselves from emergency services to healthcare services. And I think we need to change the definition. I think the definition of a paramedic is someone who is able to provide access to healthcare for a person and determine the appropriate access to healthcare.
Did you know that in 2021, some Victorians set out to define what a paramedic is?
What did they say?
And so they used a Delphi study where they basically grabbed as many different areas of paramedicine as possible to basically share what they believe it was, and they tried to put it into one definition. Are you ready for this?
Go on.
The definition is paramedicine is a domain of practice and health profession that specialises across a range of settings, including but not limited to emergency primary care. Paramedics work in a variety of clinical settings such as emergency medical service, ambulance service, hospitals and clinics, as well as non-clinical roles such as education, leadership, public health and research. Paramedics possess complex knowledge and skills, a broad scope of practice, and essential to be part of a healthcare system. Depending on location, paramedics may practice under medical direction or independently, often unscheduled. Oh my God!
Sorry,
I lost interest.
Yeah, we both went to sleep.
Now, for anyone listening out there,
what?
In order to evolve and develop, sometimes we have to offend and disagree.
Oh,
but please respectfully, right?
Thank you for doing the research. We appreciate it. This is great. However,
that is not a usable definition of paramedicine for me as a professional paramedic. That is too vague. It is too broad. It is trying to incorporate far too much. Now, there'll be arguments who say this is what it is. We've done a Delphi study, right? Well, it's one study with a very select group of opinions. Now, you know, I mean, we need this kind of thing, but that needs to be refined and simplified, because I couldn't even get to the end of it in three breaths.
So what's your definition?
Of a paramedic?
Mm.
Someone who cares for people.
I like it. Huh.
That was, you put me on the spot then, because I just gave you four words. Wait, who cares for people? Wait, I was doing syllables.
That's one word.
Okay. Anyway, moving on.
There could be multiple definitions, but if we use the idea that paramedics, one of their roles is to provide access to healthcare, whether that's a hospital, a GP, mm-hmm. a pharmacy, a virtual ED, a clinic, or nothing. Mm-hmm. Patients call us because we're usually the first point of call into healthcare, mm-hmm. and it's our job is to help them navigate where they need to go to resolve their problem. Now, if that's one of the main roles of a paramedic, then that's very difficult to do in a humanitarian aspect when you can't access the healthcare the patient needs.
If that's the primary role of a paramedic in a humanitarian deployment, then it can be challenging if you go in there expecting the structures to be there. But it is actually just a part of the role for those who are prepared appropriately to accept that we're going in there to work under a tarp for the first week and bring an element of safety to that tarp, a central point to collect and disperse.
So do you think, Lou, the role of a paramedic then is probably less about to provide healthcare, more about to provide, like if you can't provide the healthcare because you can't access the healthcare, then the role is to provide the safety, so the water, the shelter, the
food. Well, I was about to say, you still can provide the healthcare.
Mm.
Don't ever discount just the basics of providing support. You know, sometimes people just need a handheld.
Reinsurance. So,
and you know what? That's a very, very good point, because one of the first things that this paramedic and doctor did when they got on the ground after the helicopter had to return to base was that all the locals came out and said, my house has been washed away. I don't have any of my medicines. All my nightly meds are in the house. So they went and found a pharmacy. It lost power. It didn't have any water damage. So they broke in, they smashed the front door, and they went out the back. They hoarded a whole bunch of medicines and they started giving them out to patients.
I thought you were going to say they started a rave party.
You know, and that is healthcare. You think about the person with diabetes, the person with hypertension, person with AF. Mm-hmm. And if you can give them those medicines and they can continue to take them, then we're mitigating them becoming patients down in the days to weeks following.
Do you know, interestingly, years ago, I got marooned for a couple of days during a natural disaster, flood, where we ended up getting back. And the only place that we could find to even shelter ourselves in the middle of the storm was a petrol station. Now, we broke in and then found the back door open. There's a big lesson for people.
Mm.
Check the doors before you break them. But that petrol station actually turned into an emergency department because we were there over the next 4 days. And we basically had locals bringing in mattresses and sheets and towels and anything we could. But we had the same issue you're speaking of there, where you had a lot of people with a lot of medical issues they couldn't access their meds for. And so we actually created a whiteboard to figure out who in that area that was stuck possessed what medications, what we could share, which is potentially unethical and potentially illegal.
That's what I keep thinking about, the legalities of all of this.
The legalities are always challenging.
Breaking into a pharmacy.
But do the legalities only apply in normal circumstances?
So
it's a good question.
There's vague legalities here that I'm not even going to go into, but it's normally broken down to what would a reasonable person do in a similar situation.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there is a massive conflict between law and ethics that certainly challenges. And I don't actually think any paramedics are ever properly prepared for the collision of law and ethics. And when you spoke earlier in the podcast about this, you know, losing the ability to adapt, I think it just it stems from being institutional rather than being creative. We need to be creative. The clinic we set up in the petrol station was actually just, I mean, that's what we would have done in the army. I mean, the army are extraordinarily used to working in the middle of nowhere with nothing. And that's why you do just set up a tarp and bring some safety to an area that you can protect.
Mm.
And this, you know, when these structures break down, which in any deployment for disaster or humanitarian, it is a complete breakdown of societal structures, whether that be natural disaster or conflict. And it is, how do we start building those again? And if you overcomplicate it, you'll never get it done. And so in the Himalayas after the earthquakes in 2015, our first clinic that we set up in the middle of the hills there was under a tarp. And we had 200 people coming to the tarp because it was the only place that was defined as having some element of safety. With that many people, we needed to find somewhere for them to toilet rapidly that wasn't going to infect the only water supply we had for that village in that valley. And again, like this is a hugely complex problem, but one that you can simplify quite quickly by just identifying a place that is not going to contaminate the water supply and giving people one central place that is going to foul.
So as paramedics, you've been assigned to go to a disaster zone. What are some things that you would be taking to that area?
I could challenge you even further and say sometimes you actually can't take anything. You are actually limited by space so much that you've got a first aid kit. Sometimes we've deployed not knowing where we're going to sleep that night, where we're going to establish a permanent base, where we're going to get our food. There's always flip sides to coins too. There are deployments where you're not supposed to put any stress on the already impacted community. So you've got to go in completely self-sufficient. Food, water, shelter, it's got to be sorted. And then there's those other deployments where they need a rapid deployment into an area and we just don't have the ability to transport that kind of thing in. And so you've got to get there and then start trying to utilize local resources. But it's interesting because I guess what we're talking about is very adaptive operations, whether it be disaster or humanitarian, very adaptive. And you know, again, it's not a criticism of paramedicine. We are developing the profession every single day. But it is certainly a gap in that we don't educate paramedics to really be adaptive outside of those structures because there's almost this fear of law and ethics too, this fear of misunderstanding. If there was a car crash on a street in one of the Australian cities and it was on a hot sunny day, there's actually nothing wrong with putting up a tarp until services get there and can actually extract people. There's nothing wrong with holding out an umbrella. So why would people frown on that being done over a series of couple of days in an area that has nothing and shouldn't? But again, it comes from a lack of understanding. You need to adapt and you need to improvise. The things that you cannot improvise, you just can't, is drugs, medicine. Right, you can literally improvise just about everything else. You can improvise splints. You can improvise bandages. You can improvise beds. You can improvise shelter. You can clean and distill water. There's so many things you can do, but you can never improvise drugs. And so if you're going to be reliant on pharmacological interventions, that is actually going to be the one thing that you've got to prioritize above everything else because you can't make that up. But in saying that too, you've also got to have people prepared to go into these environments without equipment and without certain things. You know, like years ago, I'll try and keep the details vague, but I had a colleague, very much a COPIC in a situation on a deployment because a traumatic brain injury got brought in and all he wanted was ketamine because ketamine is what he's used for everything for his entire career. And he actually couldn't, he must have asked me to source ketamine for him about four or five times and it didn't matter how many times it would come back to, we don't have it. We need to move past that and figure out what we're going to do. It actually became an operational issue that, okay, he's actually a COPIC and he's not processing what we're telling him. And now we've actually got to gently try and remove him without causing conflict whilst we're now managing a very complicated patient in a low resource setting. So this environment is, you know, it's a hugely dynamic place to drop yourself in. Every single deployment I've done, I've always come back cringing. I could have done that better. I've learned so many things. I'm not going to make that mistake again. But they're all so different and dynamic that I don't think you can properly prepare for all of them. What you've got to rehearse and get comfortable with is the ability to adapt on the ground and improvise, but also not cowboy or cowgirl.
Fine line.
Yeah, it is a very delicate line. And again, that's that collision between law and ethics. So I don't know if I answered your question.
No, you did. Okay. My question is for paramedics and next generation paramedics, for those that do want to get into this, are there any avenues that you could recommend or suggest they look into?
When people ask me about any kind of role I've done outside of the truck, my answer is always very similar. That is, if this is something that you want to do, this is something you're interested in, stop seeking those answers in your profession. Stop hanging out with paramedics and stop idolizing the paramedics above you because they haven't done this. What we need is this
interprofessional collaboration.
Yeah, but also
it's very professional.
You also need this ability to step outside of your silo and enter into a completely different sector with your clinical skill set.
Mm.
Where would you go?
And start learning from the beginning. Well, I mean, AusAid is, you know, I mean, they're the largest government-defined organization that deploys humanitarian teams. And they do have paramedics on their deployment register now. It has been described by some as a boys or girls club. So it could be difficult to get into. I've never actually been involved in them, so I can't comment. But a lot of people will look to the larger NGOs as well. The problem with the larger NGOs is a lot of them are also institutional organizations. They're very institutionally driven, and they've been doing it their way for, you know, said number of years. And so they're very slow to change. It is some of the smaller organizations that are far more adaptive and willing to improvise, adapt, and accept. So starting to look at some of those, there's courses that people can do, you know, like there's an introduction to humanitarian principles run by, I think it's called Red R down in Victoria, like two or three times a year. I did it years ago with a colleague, and it was just a massive blinkers off moment to really get a handle on the different actors that are in the humanitarian space and how things are structured, how they collaborate. I mean, these, they're not just trying to bring healthcare into a space. That is just one of about 20 different things that they're trying to do. You know, like you've got plumbing, you've got electricity, you've got government, you've got so many different actors who are all trying to assist and work together. It is a phenomenal place to enter. But if you are interested, even if there's a first year student or a second year student thinking, you know, I'd love to work for the Red Cross one day, who knows, right? Start looking for ways now to step outside of your silo, because you're entering a silo called paramedicine. And although it is, it's a cool place to work and it's full of cool people, the problem with paramedicine is it is so siloed and no one is comfortable. I mean, most of us think we're big dogs when we're qualified. We love being the power person. We love being the important person. And when you step into these other industries, you've got to accept that you're actually one of the lower priorities at the moment, because there's so many actually above you. And it's actually, that's a tremendous opportunity to learn, develop, grow. But it takes a lot of humility.
I like it.
You wanted to talk about paramedicine outside the truck. We kind of went on some tangents around paramedic is.
I did go on some tangents today.
We're going to have to try and redefine what a paramedic is.
That could be a whole podcast.
Do you know, interestingly, I'm going to get this name wrong. I should Google it before I talk. The Royal Society of Science, if that's what it was called, it doesn't exist anymore.
Oh.
Because there's too many subspecialties of science, right? So they actually lost all their members 100 years ago, and it diluted one of the-
100
Oh, yeah, it was ago. Ages ago. It diluted one of the largest academic organizations in England. Right, because you suddenly ended up with like the Royal Society of Geography, or you know, the Royal Society of Meteorology, and all these specialist societies or academies or whatever you want to call it. And I'm going to be very controversial and say paramedicine is going to be the same. I don't think you can have one representative body to cover all of it.
Well, you don't for medicine, do you?
No, you don't.
You have all these different colleges of specialties.
You don't for nursing.
That is controversial, Sonny.
I know, but isn't it fun?
Oh, Sonny.
Isn't it fun, Lou? But it's going to take trailblazers creating a structure where there was none and professionalizing something that potentially hasn't been professionalized in our industry before.
What society would you start, Lou?
The vet nurse parent.
No idea.
Do the listeners know you're a vet nurse?
We might have brought it up.
Lou's a vet nurse. And
the Australasian Royal Society for pre-hospital
canine racer.
Cat care.
Oh.
I like it.
I think we're going to see a lot more subspecialties growing into their own professions in paramedicine. I think it's the only way forwards. I think there is just too, I mean, that definition in itself shows just how vague, or not vague, sorry, how broad the profession currently is, and you can't represent everyone from a central point with that. You need to clearly define paramedics who are working in humanitarian environments, paramedics who are working in the resource and, mining sector, paramedics who are working in the ambulance sector, paramedics who are working on cruise ships or offshore. All of these have such differing parameters that we just can't lump them all into the same boat. Hey, this was paramedicine outside the truck. This is now paramedicine outside the structures.
Oh, a new series.
A mini series to the mini series.
No.
a sub-series of a sub-series.
But if anyone wants to disagree with us, they can write to us.
Please do.
Please.
What's our email?
hello@theshiftextension.org.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I would have got that wrong.
Me too. Yeah.
But I never email us, so. If you've got a question, concern, an idea.
A query.
Let us know.
A conundrum.
Lou, thank you.
Thank you.
That was a good question.
Thanks so much, guys.
See ya.
You got to record me doing this. No, I'm joking.